backbone of our economy is small business. We recognize the stress, the strain that so many small businesses have been under, and we recognize as well our responsibility to do more and do better to help support these small businesses through this very difficult and trying time. With that said, this $7.6 billion of direct relief that we're providing today not only helps support small businesses, but support some 5.7 million Californians with direct stimulus check relief.
Governor Gavin Newsom today signing a $7.6 billion stimulus package for California. Millions of Californians will receive $600 relief payments. There's money for small businesses and relief for childcare providers and for college students. The package passed with broad bipartisan support in both chambers and comes at a time when Newsom is sparring with the legislature over school reopenings. Nicole Nixon joins me now. She's a politics reporter for Cap Radio in Sacramento. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So take us through the details of the plan. First off, who's eligible for this $600?
Yeah, there are close to 6 million Californians that are eligible. This is this whole package was really aimed, lawmakers say, at those who need more help, who've been left out of the federal stimulus packages. So very notably, undocumented taxpayers, people who file taxes with what's called an ITIN, a tax ID, will be eligible for $600. I don't think this is something that I don't think any other state has done, and Newsom mentioned that today. Also, low-income Californians, people who are eligible for the earned income tax credit, will be able to get that $600 too. And then disabled Californians. One thing is that if you are undocumented and you fall into that low income bracket, you'll be eligible for, you'll be able to double dip. You'll get the $1,200 total. And that will come as a tax rebate when you file your 2020 taxes.
Was that controversial at all, giving this money to undocumented immigrants?
You know, it sounds like it would be, but like you said at the top, this passed with bipartisan support. There was one Republican that voted against it. I don't know if that was a factor. This doesn't seem to have gotten much negative attention or it's not something Republicans were focused on this time around.
And so to get this money, though, people will have to file their tax returns, right?
Yes.
This year. So mm-hmm. their 2020 tax returns.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. And then the way that it does come through is just as that extra money when you get your tax refund, or it will go toward anything that you might owe.
So it's not immediate. People will have to wait several weeks to get this.
Correct. Although they are very much promoting this as an immediate relief, but we are in tax season now. So, when you start doing that, then yeah.
So it's a bit of an incentive to get that accomplished. How does this fit in with the federal stimulus plan? It's currently being debated in Washington.
Well, you know, Newsom and lawmakers have been talking about this for a few months now. So they actually got out ahead of Congress, getting a new round of relief out to people who are struggling. And they weren't, you know, they're not going to wait around. I guess we'll have to see. They didn't really mention a new round of talks in Congress, because, you know, it's been a few months now.
Right. Okay. And this is a lot of money. How is the state affording this?
So the state, if you remember, had a huge budget deficit last year. We're learning now that that was a bit of an overcorrection, that maybe we cut more than we needed to, and that because wealthier earners are not suffering anymore, they're still earning a lot of money, that's really benefiting the state budget. And so we're looking at a big surplus this year, actually. So lawmakers have about, you know, 15, 25, 26 billion extra dollars. This is close to 10 billion total. There is another part of this, about $2 billion, that did not pass yesterday, but lawmakers still have plans to do that. So it'll be about $10 billion. The other thing is that legislative leaders were asked if they would support maybe doing another round of stimulus. They didn't rule it out. So it could be possible that lawmakers approve another round of stimulus. I don't know if that would be checks, another round of help for small businesses. They really seem like they're looking at who's being hurt most right now, and really targeting it.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that. Who in the small business world is eligible for this relief?
Yeah, so right now the state is giving out about $500 million in grants to small businesses. Newsom's always very careful to point out that these are grants, they're not loans. It's direct aid to small businesses. They're targeting these to businesses in industries that have been hit really hard, you know, the bars and the restaurants, the salons, minority-owned businesses and women-owned businesses, to help those business owners out. This quadruples that. So it'll put another $2 billion in that pot that they can disperse to businesses that are struggling. There's also some money here, another way to help the restaurant owners and the bars and the salons. They're waiving, you know, if you have a business license, you have to pay your annual fee to the state to get your alcohol license or your cosmetology license. They're waiving those for the next 2 years to help those businesses out as well.
Right. And then what about for college students? What kind of help are they going to get?
Yeah, this is $120 million they have for extra aid, financial aid to community college students, and then some money as well for other students in the university, though that's targeted to help those students get on CalFresh, I believe. Mm-hmm. But higher ed systems did get some budget cuts last year because of that huge surplus, and those cuts will get restored with this package too.
Okay, I want to switch to the school reopening debate. There is some tension between Governor Newsom and the legislature over when to reopen schools. And today, during this bill signing, he got a lot of questions about that. And I just want to play a clip of tape where he addresses this issue.
I'm not saying we're, you know, the 1 or 2 yard line, but we're certainly in the red zone in terms of working with the legislature and the Senate and Assembly leaders and staff. And so I'll just leave it at that. We look forward to working together this week and see where we end up.
Okay, so seems a little vague, not exactly inspiring confidence there. But what's happening with this battle over school reopening?
Yeah, this is a battle that's been going on behind the scenes for several weeks now. And I'll say we heard this before a few weeks ago when they were at the negotiating table and Newsom said, hey, we might see a plan this week. We might see a plan Friday, maybe early next week. And then that ended up not going anywhere. So here we are again. Lawmakers did talk about a bill. They didn't vote on it or anything, but this bill that would basically, lawmakers introduced their own reopening plan. They talked about it. Newsom is not behind it. He says that it would take too long. School districts and a huge group of educators are pointing out their own issues with this plan that lawmakers have. The real tension, the way I see it, is that Newsom wants to get students back into classrooms as soon as possible. But they also want to make sure that they have all these safety precautions, which take time to figure those out. So I think the question that they'll have to answer is, does one of those come at the expense of the other? You know, are we determined to get students back in a classroom before the end of the school year? Or are we going to make sure that, you know, teachers are getting vaccinated in all of these counties and that every district has a plan that people are okay with and gets the sign off?
All right, we'll see what transpires. Meanwhile, school ends in a few months, so hopefully they can get something happening before then. Nicole Nixon, political reporter from Cap Radio, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much.
Well, as all of us here in California and really the rest of the world wait for more vaccines, scientists in Cuba say they're close to developing one of their own. It's called Sovereign 2. It's in its final trial stages. If successful, Cuba says, it may even be available for tourists. But with an economy battered by decades of economic sanctions from the U.S., will Cuba be able to pull this off? Here to talk more about this is Natalie Kitroff. She's a New York Times correspondent based in Mexico City. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you write in your story that as people in Cuba are waiting in long lines for basic items like bread and soap, The country is about to finalize this coronavirus vaccine. It has a thriving biotech sector. How did that happen?
Right. I mean, this is one of the many contradictions of Cuba. You know, it's a country where, you know, there's a struggle to feed the population, but at the same time, there is heavy long-term investment in a really sophisticated biotech sector. And scientists on the island have been working since March, last March, to develop this vaccine. They have four candidates, and one of them is really far along. The Sovereign 2, as you mentioned, is about to enter phase three trials, which means it'll be tested on 150,000 people between the island and Iran, which is shown also under U.S. sanctions and has shown interest in purchasing the vaccine. So we don't know about the efficacy yet of this vaccine, but we will, you know, hopefully know very soon. And the Cuban government certainly seems very optimistic.
Right. So what are they saying about it? If it hasn't gone through final trials, how do they know if it's how are they optimistic about it?
So they have results from phase one and two. They've not published them, but we spoke with the scientists developing the vaccine who have said it's shown a high level of safety in those first two phases of trial. Of course, that has nothing to do with, you know, efficiency in protecting against the virus. So that remains to be seen. But they have, the Cuban government has said that it expects to be able to produce 100 million doses this year, which is, you know, a sign that there is the expectation of mass production. And so, you know, we will wait, obviously, to see what the results are about just how efficient this new drug is. But there is certainly the plan to begin vaccinating the island very, very soon.
Wow. And this vaccine, as I understand it, is actually three doses, and you take one each.
That's right.
Each one 2 weeks apart. But you don't have to refrigerate it to those, you know, low temperatures.
Exactly. It doesn't require, you know, the, you know, really deep freeze storage that some of these other vaccines do, which would, again, pending the results and just how effective it is, make it a pretty attractive candidate for poor countries. Cuba has a history of kind of, you know, both selling and also giving away vaccines to poorer countries as a way of sort of demonstrating solidarity, as they would put it. And there is something attractive about the, you know, less onerous refrigeration requirements in countries that may not have the infrastructure to refrigerate so many doses at, you know, that deep freeze requirement.
And then they also want to lure tourists from other countries to come get vaccinated, spend some hard currency on the island.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are starting to float this idea of vaccine tourism. And one of the scientists we talked to said that, you know, one of the plans could be to vaccinate, to offer one shot on the island, and then to give you the other two to take home in your suitcase. Obviously, at a moment when we're all sort of desperately searching for vaccine appointments, the idea of people traveling to Cuba, bringing home vaccines in a refrigerated lunchbox seems just, you know, unbelievable. But it is a plan that they are floating.
Right. Okay. Well, stranger things have happened, I suppose. But the problem is, as I understand it, is that because of sanctions from the United States, Cuba is facing a manufacturing problem. Like, it doesn't have enough supplies for syringes or vials for all this vaccine. So how's it going to get all that stuff?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, the Cuban biotech sector has always had, well, you know, for the last half century or so, had to function you know, without as easy access to the raw materials, the equipment needed to manufacture at scale. And so, you know, we talked to a number of scientists who said 100 million doses is really, I mean, it would require shutting down production of a lot of other medicines on the island. So it's unclear whether they'd be able to reach that level of production. You know, there are a lot of question marks on all of this right now. But they've been able to produce, I mean, they're about to enter phase three trials in which they have 150,000 people participating. So they've obviously mm-hmm. been able to do a certain amount of production already. But yes, I mean, there are there are many unknowns in terms of the march of this island towards inoculating its entire population, potentially offering it to tourists, and then maybe exporting abroad.
And maybe President Biden will lift some of these sanctions. Has he said anything about that?
Well, what we can say at this point is there are a lot of hopes about a thawing of relations. Obviously, you know, under the Obama administration, there was a historic move towards more interaction between the U.S. and Cuba diplomatically and also, you know, people to people. I think there's a lot of hope, at least on the Cuban side and I think among some in the U.S. It's obviously a hot button issue, and there are a lot of voters who don't want to see that happen. So it remains to be seen. But at this point, Cuba is, as you probably know, buckling really under what was a tightening under the Trump administration of sanctions. The pandemic has hit them really hard. The coronavirus economic crisis is really dire in Cuba. So as you said, they need a way to bring hard currency to the island.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you.
That's Natalie Kitcheroff. She's New York Times correspondent covering Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Coming up, how Serena Williams paved the way for Naomi Osaka on and off the tennis court. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tennis player Naomi Osaka took home her second Australian Open title over the weekend.
Osaka has done it again.
The 2021 Australian Open women's singles champion, Naomi Osaka.
She is one of only seven current players, male or female, to win four Grand Slams. And then there is the huge New Year's present she got, a lucrative deal with Louis Vuitton, making her a brand ambassador for the upcoming collection. So is Naomi Osaka the future face of tennis, the current face of tennis? If so, does she face the same type of obstacles as a Black woman that Serena faced? Joining us to talk about this is Merlisa Lawrence Corbett. She's a sports journalist and author of Serena Williams, Tennis Champion, Sports Legend, and Cultural Heroine. Welcome to the program, Merlisa.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, Naomi Osaka is 23 years old, and I believe she is one of the highest paid women in tennis. She, I think, last year made more than $37 million in prize money and endorsements. So is she, at least on the financial front, eclipsing Serena Williams?
Well, she does play for Japan. So in that regard, if you're talking about endorsement, she's definitely competing, in some cases surpassing Serena Williams because of the market. I mean, she is the face of sports in Japan, whereas Serena, you know, we have NFL, bigger stars, that kind of thing. So she's cashing in, even though she lives on the West Coast here, she's definitely mm-hmm. cashing in on that Japanese market, you know, especially with the Olympics. She got a big deal because the Olympics was coming up and then they had to postpone it to this year. So I'd say she's the current face of tennis, but as long as Serena's around, she's still the most recognizable female tennis player in the world right now.
Right. So I believe right now Naomi is seated number two, Serena number seven, from what I could see. Talk a little bit more. Serena has obviously been around for many, many years. Talk a little bit about how she paved the way for Naomi on the court.
Yeah, before Serena won her Grand Slam title in the late 90s, there was more than 40 years between the time the last black woman won a title and then Serena won hers. We've had 15 Grand Slam titles by black women in the last 10 years. That's how Serena's changed things, her and Venus. Mm. So now it's not even a big deal. There's so many black women playing that you don't even bring it up anymore. In fact, with Naomi moving into the number four spot, now the top three active players in terms of Grand Slams are black: Serena, Venus, and Naomi. They're one, two, and three.
Wow. So what does that mean in terms of how tennis is perceived by the old guard? Because for such a long time, it was such a white sport. And there was a particular incident in this last match between the two with Chris Everett, the former tennis champion, now commentator, and how she has some comments she made. So I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, with Chris Everett, I mean, there's two things going on. There's one with Chris Everett kind of being out of touch in terms of cultural. She doesn't really know how to talk about black women, so she just says ridiculous stuff. So you got that going on. Then you have the hyper sensitive reaction that black women who claim Serena as their own, that they take when they feel like Serena's being slighted. So you got that mechanism kind of coming to a head. So I met Chris Everett. I don't know her well enough to know her intent, but I do know when she discusses Serena and Osaka, she tries to make it Serena's the drama one. Osaka's the preferable Negro who's very humble. That's what it comes across. Whereas men, because you got the sexism in there, men, you know, they're allowed to be. You can have Federer, he can be, you know, debonair. You can have Djokovic, who can be bombastic. You know, they are allowed to have their own personality. Women come along, we're trying to confine them to boxes, and particularly with black women. So I think that's what's happening with Chris Everett, and she will say, well, Serena brings the drama. There was no drama in this tournament. Serena was so quiet, people were thinking, what's wrong? There was no drama at all. Serena and Osaka get along just fine, but it's the way that she presents it, that, oh, Naomi's so humble. Even some of the stereotypical Asian stuff, she's so quiet. I'm like, she's just as aggressive out there, and she tells you she patterned her entire game after Serena, but you know, that's how Chrissy kind of presents those stereotypes. And it's like, she don't know what to say. So then she just says ridiculous stuff.
But there has been drama, if you will, in the past at the U.S. Open involving Serena Williams.
Only at the U.S. Open. Uh-huh. And that's what I try to point out to people. That's never happened at Wimbledon, never happened at Australia, never happened at Roland Garros. And the history of things that have happened to Serena going back to 2000s when, you know, that's the reason we have Hawkeye, that system, because she was so cheated. And it seems like in her own country, whether you're talking Indian Wells or U.S. Open, you know, like she has some kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome or something with the racism from the past. But those outbursts only happen here. So that should tell us something, that it's only happening in this country.
And what does that tell you? Does it tell you that there's something about the umps, the United States that's different than in other countries?
Well, no, the umpires are international. They travel all over the place. So I think that the guy, you know, the call he made, there's a lot of discretion. Tennis is kind of weird with the coaching. The women are allowed to have coaching, but not at the Grand Slams. Serena doesn't take coaching. So technically, you know, he could make that call. She overreacted in the last U.S. Open. The previous ones, it was a lines person. The one with Capriati, I mean, Serena was just straight out cheated. And that umpire was actually suspended. But she's still around. She wasn't fired. So it's just, I think, the dynamic where, you know, Serena's at home. She has kind of a... She has a huge fan base, but then there are a lot of people who don't like her because she did have to pave that way for Naomi. Naomi has to deal with her own stuff in Japan, where there's a different kind of racism. The whole hafu is what they call people who are half Japanese. Mm-hmm. So they got their own stuff over there. I mean, it's not like it's all good over there. But she's winning, you know, and winning kind of cures a lot of ills. I just think she's dealing with a cultural bias, but she's very, very secure in who she is. So I think in that sense, Serena paved the way for how to handle yourself, you know, and I see her doing a lot of the things that Serena did, you know, where, you know, you speak up for yourself. Don't let people tell you. They will turn on you. You saw in the final, the crowd was not behind Osaka. So she knows that, you know, she just got to go out there and win. And that I think she picked up from Serena. Just, you know, that's going to do it for you. Go out and win. Stay focused. Don't believe the hype. Don't feel so bad when things go bad. Don't believe the hype.
When do you think Serena will officially step down, retire, perhaps pass the tennis racket, if you will, to Naomi?
It's hard to say because she's still in, you know, number seven and she barely plays. I mean, right now the rankings because of the COVID are kind of messed up. She would probably be ranked higher. I think I have a – this is a theory. I don't know for sure. Everybody's making it about the record, number 24. I'm thinking she just wants to win one post-pregnancy so her daughter doesn't think she kind of ruined her legacy or something. I think getting one post-pregnancy has become a bigger issue for her than the actual record because she has the record for open era. But I think she really wants to prove that being a mother doesn't derail you. And she hasn't won one since the pregnancy. I think that's a bigger issue.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. The winning mom. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
All right. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Marlisa Lawrence Corbett is author of the book Serena Williams, Tennis Champion, Sports Legend, and Cultural Heroine. Coming up, romance scams are exploding during the pandemic, plus a review of two new reality TV shows focusing on Asian Americans.
We're so used to having affirmed the model minority stories. And so what I really want is to see a fuller spectrum of humanity out of these Asian American television shows and movies.
Those stories coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. But with all this extra time we're spending at home, clicking around on the internet, online romance scams are thriving. This is where a seemingly attractive single sends you a private message or connects with you online, builds an emotional connection, sends a bunch of sweet messages, and then the ask for money. Last year, people lost more than $300 million in these scams. And even though older people are more likely to fall victim, a lot of younger people fell for them too last year when a lot of us were stuck at home doing not much of anything. Joining me to talk about this is Rebecca Highwell. She's a reporter for Open Sourced at Vox. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, take us through how one of these scams begins. How do two people find each other?
Sure. So imagine, you know, we're in a pandemic, you're spending more time maybe on Instagram or a dating platform or a dating platform meant for sort of older adults, and you get a message from someone who, you know, seems attractive, seems nice, seems to have a lot in common with you, and you guys start building a relationship over direct messages, and, you know, over weeks and months, you start talking more and more, and eventually there's an emergency and someone asks you for money. Maybe they're stuck at the border or their kid is in some kind of trouble and they need money now and they ask for money.
And are they using real photos, real identity, or is it kind of a catfishing thing?
They're often using images that belong to other people. I've talked to an older male model who's very popular on Instagram, and his photo has been used for all sorts of scams like this.
Wow. And so then people send money because they believe that, well, they believe they're in love?
Yeah, typically this happens over like gift cards often. So someone, you know, adds a real sense of urgency. If they're someone you sort of believe you're dating and have a really strong relationship with, they will sort of make it seem like this is a now or never situation. They need you to get that gift card. They need you to send them money now. And that's how it happens.
And you say that one woman in Pennsylvania lost more than $500,000 to one of these scammers. That's so sad.
Yeah, the FBI there sent out a notice after that happened. It seems like she really got pulled in. What happened to her, it seems like, is that the scammers were pretending to be in the military, and basically she fell for it. And that's a really convenient story because it excuses the person not being there, not being able to meet in person.
Any recourse for her or any of the victims? What can they do?
It's really hard to get recourse. I think the way to think about this is, you know, if you have a family member who is on these types of dating sites or is looking for love, to really make sure that they're being careful, checking the identity of the people they're talking to, you know, teaching them how to do reverse image searches to make sure that a stolen photo isn't being used in a profile of someone they're seeing online is a better way to approach this. Because once you lose your money, it can be really hard to get it back.
Right. And also, people will sometimes fall for this multiple times, not just once.
Yeah, I mean, you know, imagine you really, really think you're in love with some guy you met on the internet. He tells you there's an emergency involving his kid and, you know, he's a scammer, and he might say, oh, I'll try it again in 2 weeks and pretend there's another emergency. And for some people who really fall deep, deep into these scams, they'll give money multiple times and they'll really drain their savings.
Is it mainly women being targeted and mainly older women?
It seems like women are deliberately targeted, especially, and, you know, the FTC has said adults sort of in that middle to older range do end up being a victim to this more than other age demographics. So, yeah, that's really the sort of sweet spot for those scammers, unfortunately.
Are the scammers organized into rings, or is this kind of ad hoc?
It seems like often they are organized. You know, the male model that I mentioned, who's very, finds his face used for a lot of these scams, says he really believes there's an organized operation that has learned his image is very successful for tricking these women. And he thinks it's really, really organized and well studied. It's not just, you know, one person, though it could be. I think these are, you know, big operations.
So, I mean, big picture, it does tell you something about what happens when we're all trapped at home, isolated and desperate for some kind of connection, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of a symptom of people being more lonely. And also COVID has just made the excuses for not meeting in person easier. So, you know, you might one day say, oh, I'll, you know, check out this person and meet in person. But now suddenly a scammer can say, oh, I just tested negative for COVID. I don't have to see you in person. Let's stay on direct messages.
And by the way, can you slide me $100?
Right, exactly.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Heilweil, reporter for Open Sourced at Vox. Coming up, the guilty pleasure of the TV show Bling Empire. We'll have a review next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, today, TV shows in the mold of the hit film Crazy Rich Asians.
Family has business with the airline. The tickets, they're a perk.
What kind of business?
Real estate, investment, other things, nothing interesting. Dim sum.
So your family is, like, rich?
We're comfortable.
That is exactly what a super rich person would say.
Well, released in 2018, that movie was the first major studio film with an all-Asian cast in more than 20 years. It was a critical and financial success. And now reality TV appears to be trying for the same with two new shows, literally about Crazy Rich Asians, Bling Empire on Netflix and House of Ho on HBO Max. They both follow the lavish parties, the vacations, the drama, the petty sniping, typical of reality TV. And both shows have led to many, many think pieces and debates on social media about whether or not this type of representation is good for Asian Americans. Here to talk more about this is Ingu Kang. She is TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me to discuss such an illustrious topic.
Well, you call it in your story, representational trash, this kind of TV programming. What does that mean?
This is a phrase that I coined in order to describe this very special niche of television that I am like inexorably drawn to and yet sort of feel guilty about. Basically, it's how I describe reality TV show that has historically been, for me as an Asian American viewer, been very important because for so long there was so little Asian American representation on screen. And so the few little tidbits where I saw faces that looked like my own and could see experiences that mirrored something of my own was in reality TV, because reality TV always has to have really great casting. And so that can sometimes mean having a white protagonist. And sometimes it could mean, just like in real life, an Asian person might be much more interesting than a white protagonist.
Well, how many times do you see Asians in reality TV before now?
I would say I have two very vivid memories of seeing Asians in reality TV. They both happened about 10 years ago. One was on Survivor. I remember very specifically Brenda Lowe, who was just like this kind of Asian woman I had never seen before. She was really tan. She was super athletic. She was so carefree in a bikini. And of course, Asian women are sexualized everywhere. But I think she was someone who seemed very much in control of her beauty in like a very relaxed way. And also it was completely married to her athleticism. And I think other than maybe figure skating, I think Asian American female athleticism is something that's even rarer to find. The other example is actually a very local one. There used to be a web series called K-Town about K-Town, and it was basically supposed to be LA's answer to Jersey Shore. And they made two seasons. They tried really hard to sell it as sort of like a copycat version of that. And it didn't really go anywhere because I think in 2012, people were not ready for this type of stereotype busting trashy reality show about Koreans who just wanted to drink. And that's a group of people that I have grown up with. And it was so fascinating to see basically the kind of like dudes and himbos that I went to church with growing up actually on a screen being the protagonists of their own story. And so do I want to spend time with those guys in real life? I don't know. But did I really love seeing them on YouTube? Absolutely.
Well, now we have Bling Empire on Netflix, and I just want to play a clip from the trailer.
Just go shopping. That's the best therapy.
It's really hard to flex your abs all day long. You have to hold your breath.
In China, my husband's father would be an emperor, and baby G would be a little prince. Kind of need your help.
Did you bring Botox?
I only want a date for love. I'm so tired of other people's judgment.
Kim Lee is a super famous DJ.
You got it. Flaunt it.
Cherise heirs to huge denim empire. And now Anna's back. Her father sells bombs, guns.
Oh my gosh, this has it all. It's got abs, bombs, guns, Botox. What more could you want from reality trash TV?
I don't know, like a storyline that actually works or a character that I don't hate.
Oh my gosh, you're asking for too much, I think. So is it really that vapid?
I think it's pretty vapid. I think even by like reality show standards, it's a pretty bad show. I think even if you're watching something like 90 Day Fiancé or The Real Housewives of wherever, there tend to be cohesive characters. There tend to be storylines that you're supposed to at least get semi-attached to. And I think if you watch Bling Empire to the very end. You can tell based on how many times the group takes a trip to a shaman or a palm reader or a fortune teller or whatever, that they sort of just ran out of storylines. And so they sort of have to create these spectacles in order to fill out the runtime. I am not a fan of this show.
Yeah, sounds like it.
But of course, the main attraction of the show is to basically gawk at this luxury and this spectacle. And I think, you know, I think that's fine. I think the place where it really drops the ball for me is that it's billed in some ways, because I think Crazy Rich Asians is name dropped in the first minute of the show, that I think the show is trying for a certain kind of representation. And I think the reason why it doesn't really get there is that it doesn't seem very interested actually in either Asians or Asian Americans. It's more interested in sort of gawking at them. And in gawking at them, it sort of tends to re-exoticize the very people it's supposed to be about.
So if this is a spectacle and it's gawking, is it for a different audience? Is it for a white audience primarily, do you think?
It seems to me like it's functioning for a white gaze, because the characters tend to be so shallow. The most interesting thing about them basically tends to be how rich they are and how strangely they spend their money. But a lot of the time, the way that they spend their money is also, again, re-exoticized, where they will go to an herb store and then there will be a whole conversation about how crazy it is that Asians would spend this many thousands of dollars on one herb. Or they would go to a palm reader, and it's supposed to be crazy that these people believe in palm reading. And I think that the other thing that sort of tends to be disappointing is that all of the characters constantly refer to quote-unquote Asian culture, even though, I don't know, like as an Asian, if I'm talking among other Asian friends who are not like of the same ethnicity with me as me, we tend to sort of parse out like, what is this like in your culture? Is this like a thing that we have in common? Or is this something more specifically Korean or something more specifically Chinese? And there isn't really that differentiation. It's always just like Asia as a monolith. But that monolith represents more than a billion people.
Okay, let's move on to House of Ho. This is about a woman named Judy Ho, the daughter of Vietnamese refugees. It's set in Houston, Texas. And here's a bit from the trailer.
My family is Vietnamese, but loves being American. My brothers are named Washington and Reagan.
I was a disappointment because I was a girl, so I'm named Judy.
My parents are refugees, so they came over here in 1975.
Most Vietnamese families settled in Houston because of the tropical weather.
My dad's retirement is coming up. I'm taking over.
All right, what did you think of this show? Did you like it better?
I like it so much better. The show is quite uneven. I will be the first to admit this. I saw the first three episodes before it came out, and I like completely wrote it off. On a complete whim, I decided to go back and finish out the season. And then I ended up really adoring this show. I think in many respects, it's a type of Asian American story that is very familiar to a lot of people. It is a story about a family in which the sexism of the story basically destroys the self-esteem of like the daughter in the family. And it's not only coming from the father and the mother, but also the siblings as well. House of Ho is basically about how there are these adult siblings who are around 40. And basically Judy is constantly overlooked. And these traditional gender roles are not only weighing down on Judy, it really affects every single member of the family, including the brother, including her father even, who is in many ways the enforcer of these traditional values. And yet he has clearly made his own life harder because of his own sexism.
So she's going through a divorce, and that I guess is a no-no in this family. Why is that so looked down upon?
I think that the family, and like a lot of conservative families, they're Catholic. And so divorce is always going to be disapproved. I think there's an Asian factor there, and then there's also other factors like religion and geography. And basically, the story is really interesting in a lot of ways because it's the type of story that we would assume maybe if this was about a white girl or woman, like freeing yourself from your parents' independence story that I think a lot of people undergo in their late teens. And for Judy, she's really spent all of her life suppressing that desire for independence until finally she says, you know, like, I'm going to be turning 40. Of course, on the show, there's a very lavish party. And there's something, of course, a little bit sad about the fact that she's waited until her 40th birthday in order to assert her independence. But it says so much about the family dynamics in this clan that she has felt like she has had to wait until age 40 in order to assert her independence.
So as you look at the landscape of TV shows, either reality shows, dramas, or comedies that feature or star Asian Americans, are you seeing more representation? Are you seeing any glimmer of hope? Or what are you seeing? And what would you like to see more of?
I would say I feel more than a glimmer of hope. I feel a lot of hope. I remember very strongly, my mom and I used to watch The Wonder Years together. You know, this is at least, what, 2 decades ago. And we would sit around the living room arguing over whether Winnie Cooper, who was played by Danica McKellar, was Asian or not. Because even though my mom also watched her Korean shows on the side, she watched a lot of American TV with us. And I feel like even though she's someone who was extremely inured to seeing Asians in Asian media, I think she sort of understood somewhere that, like, we, her children growing up in America, were not seeing other Asians who were speaking English and living in America. And I think that she wanted it for us so badly that she was convinced that Danica McKellar was Asian and would, like, continually tell me that that was the case, even though I was pretty sure she was wrong. So we've obviously come an extremely long way, but I think the thing that gives me the most hope is that we're so used to having affirmed the model minority stories. And so mm-hmm. what I really want is to see a fuller spectrum of humanity out of these Asian American television shows and movies. I think one show that's maybe a little bit uneven, but I really love is Awkwafina's show on Comedy Central. Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. It's a terrible title. But basically, if you had told me 5 years ago that on a mainstream cable network, you were going to have an Asian American star starring as a stoner who is constantly bumbling around from gig to gig. And by the way, she lives with her dad and her grandmother, and they never have any conversations about, like, oh, how she has to go to law school or how she has to earn lots of money. Like, it's so refreshing.
Yeah, it's refreshing that even Asian Americans can have a non-achieving, you know, slacker character.
Yeah, and there's lots of us. Many of us are high achieving and many of us are rather low achieving.
I.e. human.
Yeah.
Ingu Kang, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.